Demonstrators in the capital, Tunis, climbed on top of the roof of the Interior Ministry.
The overthrow of long-time Tunisian leader Zine El Abidine Ben Ali has stunned the region and worried neighbouring leaders.
They want Hosni Mubarak, the president they see as corrupt, to resign and allow full democratic elections for the first time in 30 years.
A wall of sound as Egypt's Vice President Omar Suleiman announces that President Hosni Mubarak will step down.
One by one, cities across Libya have exploded in violence as the anti-government protests spread through the country, demanding the dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, leave power.
For almost 40 years, the Arab world was dominated by authoritarian regimes. But in 2011, hundreds of thousands of Arabs from Morocco to Syria took to the streets demanding democratic reform. Hello, I'm Annabel Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National Summer. Today, we take a look at the history of the Arab world and how that history led to the political unrest that erupted in the Arab world last year. But first, just in case you haven't heard, from the end of January, Rear Vision is moving to a new time slot, Sunday after the 12 o'clock news. So hope you can join us then or podcast us as usual. The Arab world consists of 22 Arab-speaking countries stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Arabian Sea, taking in much of the Middle East and North Africa. Yusuf Sweri is the Director General of the Centre for Arab Unity Studies in Beirut.
It's estimated there are about 300 million Arabs or Arabic-speaking peoples. It's not an ethnic identity, it is a cultural identity in the sense that they all speak Arabic. Not all Arabs are Muslims. There are quite substantial Christian minorities. So generally speaking, it's not a religious identity and not all Arabs are Muslim, but the majority do consider themselves to be Muslim.
According to Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said, Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, Arab speakers have had a pride in Arab culture for centuries, even before the Golden Age of Islam, when Arab culture led the world in philosophy, medicine, science and law. But it wasn't until the end of the 19th century that some Arab speakers began to articulate the idea of an Arab political identity.
Well, there is certainly a sense of Arabness, of Arab ethnicity, of pride in the Arab language and in Arab heritage and in pre-Islamic poetry, and of Arabic as the language of the Quran going way, way back. I mean, a couple of millennia, certainly, till before the Islamic era. But the idea of Arabism or of Arab nationalism as a political identity is a very much more recent phenomenon. It's a late 19th century, early 20th century phenomenon. Before the Paris Peace Conference, before the Treaty of Versailles, certainly, but not much before. A couple of generations before, at most, two, maybe three, would be the first stirrings of modern Arab national consciousness.
For over 500 years, the Arab world was part of and ruled by the Ottoman Empire. By the beginning of the 20th century, there were some Arabs beginning to agitate for independence. Adeed Dawisha is Professor of Political Science at Miami University and the author of Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair.
Before the First World War, the thinkers and the writers who talked about an Arab nationalism that would unite all Arabs and separate them ethnically, linguistically, and therefore, by definition, politically, from the Turks of the Ottoman Empire, mainly were actually Christian writers and Christian thinkers. The Muslim Arab thinkers didn't really advocate separation from the Ottoman Empire. Now, that, in a sense, became moot after the First World War because the Ottoman Empire collapsed. And so then, whether you were Christian or Muslims, neither here nor there, because now that the Ottoman Empire has collapsed, they began to agitate for independence, and this time independence from the Western powers, France and Britain. And in that sense, the clarion call for Arab nationalism became really intense after the First World War, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and gathered momentum in the 1920s and the 1930s.
The Great War was over. On the 11th of November 1918, an armistice had been signed.
Britain had gained the support of the Arabs against the Ottoman Empire during World War I by promising them an independent homeland.
Well, the British were very canny and shrewd, as they can be. Their promises were always veiled and hedged around and obscure, and they made different promises to different people at the same time as they were making promises to various Arab leaders or in various public statements. They were making secret promises to others or public promises to yet others. For example, they were making secret promises to the French and the Russians at the same time as they were making both secret and later public pledges to the Arabs, and then they later on made the pledge to the Zionist movement in the Balfour Declaration, leading one wag to call Palestine the thrice-promised land, because in fact there were three different promises that the British made with regard to Palestine in particular.
The treaty dismembered Germany and its allies, the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. These large and powerful states were to be broken up so that the various ethnic groups they contained would have their own separate countries.
The Arabs found themselves utterly betrayed by the British. They were not going to be independent.
Robert Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for the UK newspaper The Independent and the author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East.
The Americans wanted, interestingly enough, and the King Crane Commission, which was sent against the wishes of the British and French to the Middle East by the Americans, the Americans wanted, and the State Department diplomats of the dying Ottoman Empire recommended, and so did the local NGOs, who were then, of course, missionaries, that there should be one democratic Arab state stretching from the Atlantic on the shores of Morocco to the Persian-Mesopotamian border, which today we call the Iranian-Iraq border. And the Americans pushed for this. They thought they could have a modern Arab state, not as big as the British Empire perhaps, but certainly large enough to be a balance against other empires further east. And of course the British and French opposed this and chopped up the region and kept it for themselves, and that is one of the Middle East tragedies, that we went around after Versailles drawing lines in the sand, which in many cases did not represent reality. For example, in the border between Transjordan, now Jordan, and Mesopotamia, now Iraq, the line cut through villages, homes, fields, tribes. This was part of the tragedy of the post-First World War world, where we thought we were going to reintroduce democracy in a world safe from war, you know, the war to end all wars.
So what was the response in the Middle East directly after they discovered that they hadn't got the independence they were hoping to get?
Well, the first response was that the Arabs decided that they would honour their agreements with the British and try to set up a kingdom in Syria, in Damascus. They raised their flags, the Arab flags, over Damascus. At one point, Arab cavalry actually got to Beirut and raised the Arab flags over the city and port of Beirut. But when the French arrived under General Henri Gouraud, they decided immediately that they wanted a separate Lebanon governed by Christians who would be loyal to France. And General Henri Gouraud effectively decided he had put down the Arab rule in Damascus in the most colonial way. He drove his tanks across the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon, and when confronted by the Arab government of Damascus and their forces, at a great battle at a place called Maysaloun, the French slaughtered the Arab army. The Minister of Defense, who was actually fighting from horseback, an Arab, was brought off his horse and he was executed. He was tied to a tree and executed by French troops. The French then marched into Damascus, and with great pomposity, General Gouraud marched into the great Umayyad Mosque to the tomb of Saladin, the great Arab warrior who defeated the Crusaders, and said, "Saladin, we are back." Churchill effectively carved out of the great oil-soaked deserts of the east the state of Iraq, as it came to be known. The British occupied it totally in 1922. The Iraqis, enraged at the fact that the promises of independence had been broken to them, rose up in an insurgency against the British in Iraq. General Maud, when he'd led the British in 1917, put up a big poster on the wall saying, "We've come here," meaning the British Army, "have come here not as conquerors but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny." We've heard that more recently from certain other military and political leaders in the West. In any event, an insurgency broke out in Iraq in 1920. So we had Iraq in arms, Palestine in uproar. There was a considerable, constant rebellion against French rule by the Sunni Muslims of Syria. And it was a great tragedy that took place in the Middle East. And all the while, of course, the Arabs nursed the realization that they had been lied to, if not deliberately betrayed, that the men who gave them and offered them independence must have known about the Sykes-Picot Anglo-French agreement made in secret in Paris to carve up the Middle East between the victorious powers after the First World War.
Well, I mean, the ideal of Arab nationalism, in fact, is inflamed by these partitions. People oppose strenuously the idea that the Europeans can come in and carve up the Arab world as they see fit. So, yes, the outcomes that resulted from these partitions between Britain and France were certainly not to the liking of the Arabs, but they have determined the countries, the nation states in which the Arab world has grown up in. Elites begin to develop around each capital, interests begin to develop around the nation state, education is done on a national basis, i.e. within Egypt, within Iraq, and so on and so forth, as these countries very gradually achieve degrees of independence. It takes a long time before these countries are actually independent. And one of the problems that they face is each has different circumstances for its struggle for independence, and so each tends to go off on a separate path. So the Syrians have to struggle against the French in specific circumstances, the Iraqis against the British in different circumstances, and so on. By the time they achieve their independence, most of them, well after World War II, they have been struggling against a different imperial form of imperial rule within the boundaries of what become nation states. And after World War II, or at the very end of World War II at Alexandria, when the League of Arab States is formed of the first few independent Arab states, one of the principles is maintaining these nation states. And that has been a principle of the Arab League ever since. So, in fact, these national elites, in a very short period of time, coalesce around these new entities. And this is a countervailing force to Arab nationalism, nation-state nationalism of, say, Tunisia, of, say, Jordan, of, say, Kuwait, of entities which in some cases didn't even exist before World War I.
You're with Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the history of the Arab people. It wasn't until well after World War II that many of these Arab nations gained their independence. And while there were experiments with democracy, they didn't last. And in the 1950s and 60s, most Arab states moved towards authoritarian regimes.
You can understand it by looking at what kind of nationalism the Arabs were propagating, and indeed what kind of political institutions the colonial powers had. The nationalism that the Arabs propagated was a cultural nationalism that was borrowed from the Germans of the 19th century. The German cultural nationalists of the 19th century were not democrats. They were more corporate. They believed in the strength of the German people. And when they talked about freedom, they talked about freedom from the outsider, and that struggle to achieve this freedom superseded anything else. Unlike, for example, the Anglo-French theorists, who, when they talked about freedom, they talked about individual rights, the freedom of the individual. And so the nationalism that the Arabs propagated was not a democratic nationalism. When they talked about freedom, they talked about freedom from the colonialists. When they talked about Arab nationalism, they talked about the political unity of the Arabs. That was the goal. And if that goal was going to happen at the hands of a political leader who is an authoritarian figure, then so be it. Then the second thing was that which countries were the most democratic countries? It was Britain and France. So when you are an Arab and you're struggling in order to free your countries out of the clutch of these colonialists, you're not just against the foreign policy of that state, you become against all the symbols that these countries stand for, and indeed all the institutions. And so because Britain and France were democratic, an Arab would say, I really have absolutely no intention of adopting their system of government.
The interwar period and the early post-war period witnessed democracies that had been sabotaged by colonial rule and that had failed to deal with colonial rule. And so people naturally looked for a different alternative. The alternative they turned to was one that, in fact, diminished personal freedom and that ultimately abolished democracy. So you had a parliamentary democracy in Egypt for 30 years. The problem was the British were always there and sticking their big fat thumb on the scales and preventing the Egyptian people from exercising a self-determination. And democracy, in part, as a result, was discredited. So what you had in Iraq, what you had in Egypt, what you had in Syria, what you had in those countries that did have parliamentary systems immediately after World War II was a shift towards authoritarian regimes, in many cases military regimes or single-party regimes, all of which ended up being autocracies, some of which ended up being hereditary autocracies. In the case of Syria, you actually have had power handed down from a so-called president of a so-called republic to his son. That is apparently what President Mubarak was planning before the Egyptian people had their say. So what took place in the 50s and the 60s ultimately produced autocratic regimes, which in fact are now being threatened for the first time in four decades.
The other event that impacted on the Arab world was the creation of the State of Israel.
Soviet Union, yes. The United Kingdom, abstain. The United States, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
The result of the vote sent both Jews and Arabs through the streets of Jerusalem, the Jews dancing in joy and the Arabs rioting in anger. British responsibility ended on May the 15th, 1948. On the same day, amid scenes of great emotion, David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the independent state of Israel. There was little time for celebration. Within hours, the new state was at war with the four Arab countries surrounding it. For 6 months, the fighting continued. The Israelis lost the old city of Jerusalem to Jordan, but managed to hold on to most of their territory elsewhere.
The 1948-49 war was a different learning experience from the 1967 war. In both cases, the Arabs lost to Israel. But the lesson that the Arabs drew from 1948-49 was, in fact, we lost to Israel because we did not have a strong nationalist spirit to unite us, and we were prey to our rulers, who are all corrupt, who are all pro-West, and therefore, by the time Nasser emerged and then his emulators later on in Iraq and in Syria and all of these other countries, the clarion call was for a strong leader who would literally take his country, whether it's Nasser in Egypt or Qasim in Iraq or Gaddafi in Libya later on, whatever. But these guys were supposed to take their people and their country by the scruff of the neck and literally jolted into the 20th century to make it, first of all, compete with the West, but also to make it strong enough economically and politically and militarily to confront Israel. That was the lesson that was learned from 48-49. We were weak, we were divided, we had all these strange ideas, we were led by corrupt government, therefore we needed strong, authoritative leaders who will basically order us and make us advance and be like the Western countries and eventually beat Israel. That was the lesson learned in 48-49.
July the 26th, 1956. Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal Company. A speech by Nasser was a national event in Egypt, not just for the thousands who gathered in the square to hear him and to see him, but also for the millions up and down the country who listened on the radio and television. Because Nasser stood for more than just the Egyptian government. He was the leader of his people to a peculiar and a unique degree.
He certainly brought Arab people together. There is no doubt that between 1955 and 1970, certainly till 1967, but I would say even till the day he died in October of 1970, during those two decades, or about 16 years, there is no doubt that the Arab people felt they had a leader. If there was a time when you could say the Arabs, regardless of where they were living, in Casablanca or Rabat in Morocco, or in Doha in Qatar, or in Baghdad, the vast majority of them believed that Nasser was their leader, because he was the leader of the Arab national movement. And many of these people identified themselves first as Arabs and only second as Iraqi or Syrian or Moroccan or Tunisian and so on and so forth. So he certainly brought the Arab people together.
Abdel Nasser and the Egyptian regime that emerged from the 1952 revolution were important for several reasons. First, because they finally liberated Egypt from British military occupation, which had continued without interruption from 1882 until finally the Egyptian regime imposed on the British a full withdrawal against the wishes of Winston Churchill, who was then Prime Minister, and then of his successor, Anthony Eden. And secondly, because Egypt immediately moved to a leadership position in the Arab world as the largest Arab country, as the sort of intellectual center of culture and literature and the arts, as a centrally located country in the Arab world. Egypt was naturally placed to be the leader, and Abdel Nasser and his regime played that role to the hilt, and they therefore had an inordinate impact on Arab politics right up until the defeat of 1967.
Monday, June the 5th, 1967, dawns on the forces poised as they have been for weeks against one another. Suddenly, at 8:10 in the morning, a music broadcast is interrupted for an announcement.
The Egyptians this morning launched an air and land attack. At dawn, Egyptian armor advanced on the Negev.
Israeli radio announcing their version of how the 1967 war with the Arab states began.
In 1967, it was a different lesson, because by 1967, you had almost two decades of nationalist rhetoric, of nationalist policies, of nationalist institutions, including authoritarian politics, including a one-party system, including a socialist economy. All of these were connected to the notion of nationalism. And the idea was, give us time, give us a decade or two, and then we will get to a point where our achievements would be such that we would then be able to compete with the West, and more importantly, will be strong enough to defeat the Israelis and regain the rights of our Arab Palestinian brothers. Well, in 1967, after 20 years of the socialist, nationalist, authoritarian experiment, what happens? The Arabs actually lose, and not just lose, but lose in one of the most humiliating defeats that they had ever experienced. So the message was very different now. Whereas 48-49, it catapulted nationalism into the center stage. In 1967, it literally became the death warrant for nationalism.
Is that when we start to see the emergence of a more radical Islamic approach?
Yeah, it didn't happen immediately. But if you look at the emergence of radical Islam, it begins, in fact, after 1967. So if you were a radical, you now begin to look for radical alternatives. And the other universal idea, the other universal force that is supposed to, or you would expect to deliver the same kind of results for you, was radical Islam. So many of these radical guys, whether they were nationalists or even some of the Marxists, literally within 6 months to a year, had become radical Islamists.
That's correct. There are many sources for this. One of them is the failure of secular alternatives, whether it's secular democracy, whether it's socialism, whether it's communism, or whether it's Arab nationalism. One of them is the fact that many of these regimes drove the left and the secular and liberal alternatives out of the public sphere with police state repression, but could not do the same in the mosques, could not do the same with religious movements. And as a result, what you had, and in some cases, religious movements were actually employed by the regime, as, for example, in Egypt, under Sadat, who used the religious right as a tool to defeat his domestic opponents.
The wave of anti-government unrest continues to spread across the Arab world. In Morocco, at least five people have died after protesters took to the streets across the country. Similar protests in Yemen have now claimed at least 12 lives. Tunisians have staged new rallies demanding their ousted leader be extradited to face corruption charges. And in Bahrain, thousands of people continue to occupy central Pearl Square, demanding the ruling family give up some of its power.
What you're having is an expression of sentiments and aspirations that seem to cut across different classes and groups and age groups within the Arab world, and that transcend a number of divisions that everybody thought were hard and fast. In other words, it happens to be the case that most people in the Arab world, or many people in the Arab world, have a sense of what's going on in the rest of the world. They understand that other people benefit from some elements of democracy and constitutional rule, and they want that for themselves. They understand that you don't have to have nepotism and corruption to have free market system, that those things can be separated. One of the aspects of the liberalization that Anwar Sadat started and that the Mubarak regime has continued has been the development of monstrously corrupt crony capitalism. And people are revolted by that. It's not so much they're against capitalism, it's they're against the kind of favoritism that makes billionaires out of the ministers. Those are commonly shared sentiments, which mean that people in the Arab world actually are like everybody else in most other parts of the world. They have similar aspirations towards freedom and some social justice. And the tides that have affected the rest of the world affect this part as well. It is not, in other words, a place made up of crazy fundamentalists who, if you allow them to have a free system, will turn towards extremism. What we've seen in Tunisia so far, what we're seeing in Egypt so far, has been an expression of this exact same kind of sentiments that we saw in Eastern Europe at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. We saw in South Korea, we saw in Brazil, we saw in other countries that have managed to overcome autocracy and move towards democracy.
I think this is the beginning of a new historical period in the Arab world. People used to think that the Arab world had a passive culture, that people always waited for the state to do something, and the state was treated as an enemy all the time. There was no autonomous social organization in the Arab world. This is no longer the case. And I think this is the most important change in the general political culture, in the sense that people have become more confident and they have discovered a way of organizing themselves in order to achieve certain demands. And this will go on and pass through one state after another. From now on, no single Arab regime will be immune. This social movement will not leave things as they were. And within 10 years, you will have a different Arab world.
It would seem to me that we have already seen the barrier of fear, the heavy weight of despair and hopelessness that overhung most people in the Arab world, lifting partially. People have a sense of hope for the first time in decades. People realize that you can change your life, that the alternatives are not either a police state or a bunch of bearded lunatics. And that was an equation that the regimes sold day and night. It's either us or you will have to take Islamic fanaticism. You must put up with police states, you must put up with no democracy, you must put up with torture, you must put up with violations of human rights, because the alternatives is the Islamic loonies will eat you up. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if that means that the Middle East is in for a dawn of democracy. I think there are very powerful forces that will try and maintain the status quo in many of these Arab countries. But what I do know is that something certainly has changed in people's psychology. The genie may well be out of the bottle, and I think it'll be very, very hard to put it back.
Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, ending today's program. Our other guests, Yusuf Shweri, Director of the Center for Arab Unity Studies in Beirut. Adeed Dawisha, author of Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair, and journalist and author Robert Fisk. Today's sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage, and don't forget that from February, Rear Vision has a new time slot, Sunday after the midday news, so catch us then. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National Summer.